This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Glenn Fleischman. He's a freelance writer and editor who's currently a contributing editor at Macworld magazine. He's also written for The Economist, The Atlantic, and Boing Boing. He's also a regular contributor on The Incomparable podcast at theincomparable.com. And you can find him online at glennf, with two N's, in glenn.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter at glennf. But beware, he tweets a lot. No, really, more than that. A lot. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm going to start out with people who have heard you on podcasts before know about the term glenning, and I'm going to start my own glenning here and say that I've had Andy Anatko and Merlin Mann and Cory Doctorow on the show before.
Right on.
And the reason I have people like that and people like you on is because I hear you on other podcasts and you talk about how much you love libraries and how much you use libraries. How much of a library user on a regular basis would you say you are?
Oh, like a constant one. And I've got two kids who are age 9 and 11, and we have trained them well to be library users as well. And we are incredibly lucky because I live in Seattle. Seattle loves libraries. We love our libraries. We paid, I can't remember what it was. It was several years ago. We approved some ridiculously large levy to like overhaul the whole library system. And it paid for a good chunk. Have you been to the Seattle Central Library?
Yes, yeah, the Central one. Yeah, that's beautiful too.
We go down there basically as often as we can because it's a work of art. I mean, I would love to know how the librarians feel about working in the building. I heard a little bit of feedback over the years after it was built that it's not bad. Like there's some awkwardness to it. And before it opened, librarians were, there were a lot of local stories because the Renzo Piano, the architect, came in and made all these really strange statements about what he thought a library would be. And like librarians would be wearing tags, they'd walk around and they'd be uplit by lights that recognized where they were. And everyone's like, oh, okay, this may not be right. And then they went through public review and they built the thing and it's incredibly functional. And I think, we were just there, we had to consult several librarians on a quiet day recently to find different things. And it's just, I don't know, I just love it. But so we funded this enormous levy. It paid for a good hunk of the Central Library, but we also raised, I don't know, like $100 million for it. So it's a work of art. It's modern. It has storage up and down the wazoo. But one of the things it paid for were to build new branches where in some underserved neighborhoods, they built much larger ones. And in my neighborhood, we had like a storefront. It used to be like a bar because there was like a bar counter that was our library. Yeah. And it was this tiny thing. And our neighborhood was growing and growing. We're right near the university. And they got this, so they got money for it. And they're like, oh, great, we're going to get a new library. They cited it. Everything was cool. Then the price of steel started to climb in China, one of these weird things. And so they're like, okay, we can't build the library we planned because we'd go so far over budget with the steel component, which is bizarre. So they have to re-engineer on wood. And they put out a sketch. And it looks like Mr. Brady from the Brady Bunch had designed this thing. And we're like, oh, no. And then, you know, again, review process and whatever. And they built it. And it's lovely and gorgeous. And I'm so glad they actually had to use engineered wood because the interior has a beautiful sound. It's not noisy or reflective. And, you know, we know some of the librarians at our branch, they moved from the old storefront to the new location and they've been there, you know, as long as I've been in this neighborhood, 20 plus years. So we're down there all the time. One of the librarians collects, you know, those bread tags that have a date on them, the little snap on lock tag.
Yeah.
So we discovered that she's collecting those. So we've been collecting them and bringing the dates she's missing because she's trying to assemble a full year. One of my sons had a jag where he was writing a book for a while and he wrote quite a bit of it. And so, you know, we go there, librarians are like, hey, how's the book going? Want to see if it's done. So we are, I would say, pretty keyed in.
Yeah, and there are some libraries, I don't believe Seattle's one of them, but there's some of them where you can bring your manuscript in and they have machines that will make a ebook, that will make a printed copy for you.
How do we not have that?
I think, I want to say San Francisco, somewhere in California has that. I think San Francisco has that. That's pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome. There's we have an espresso print-on-demand system at a Third Place Books. It's a local small chain of great new and used bookstores. They have one up at a location that's several miles from us, but I think you can take in, they will do print on demand, but I think you can also have them make a book for you there for some fee.
That's great. Because that's really bad because libraries are a lot about content creation now too, not just people consuming things, but we're trying to help people create things and create that conversation now. So that's awesome.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in that. There's like that dividing line. I have this idea for a book. I'm going to tell people exclusively on this podcast.
Shh, don't tell me.
Because I want support for it. So, you know, the 1922 cutoff, everybody in library sciences and copyright fields and, you know, everything knows this cutoff, right?
Right. Yep.
So 2019, January 1st, 2019, 1923, everything from that year goes in the public domain, right? I want to produce a book somewhere probably across 2018 that publishes at midnight, you know, Eastern time or whatever the farthest zone is. That's what the year that was 1923 told through public domain resources that were not public domain until that moment. So that is an idea I have. I have a couple years to plan for it.
But, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I figure there's a lot of people interested in the public domain as an institution, and I've talked to folks that there's Duke has an Institute of the Public Domain. I've talked to them, and you know they don't have the money to support something, but they're like, oh, that's a really interesting idea. And so as time goes by, I will reach out further and further to people. But I think it would be great to assemble. It's going to be hard to get the resources because mm-hmm. a lot of those aren't digitized or some are orphaned works. So until, you know, 2019, it would be not risky necessarily, but it would be difficult to say right. with certainty and so forth. So, but I'm interested in that, how that plays in with like print on demand and other resources digitization libraries are doing. Like there's going to be soon, unless there's a copyright extension, which I think is very unlikely at this juncture in time, we're going to have these waves of new material available for, you know, for online access.
Well, that really fits in with a lot of what you've done in the past. I mean, you've done a lot of experiments with publishing in the past, and I have tried to follow along with a lot of that with the magazine and things like that. And I enjoyed a lot of your podcasts that haven't made it very long, but
sorry. I keep trying things. My thing is I try stuff, and I'm always willing to let projects die. Like, you know, something is working, it stops working. I put a good faith effort into fixing it, and like, all right, this has had a nice shape, and now we're done. So, like the new Disruptors podcast I did lasted, I think, 93 episodes, and it mm-hmm. kind of hit a natural endpoint. And the magazine lasted 28 months, I think it was, but revenue was down. I still had money to refund everybody. And Apple wasn't changing what it was doing with periodical apps. It had killed the newsstand off. It was like, all right, this is a great time, and I can kind of clean the books off, and nobody loses money. I'm not in bad shape, and we've done it. So finding the death date, like calling it, for a project is a really good thing to do. It's very good to have closure.
Well, can you give me officially, is the Periodicalist dead? I still have it. No, I still have it in my overcast.
I still want to revive it. I think I've done 8 episodes of that. What I really need is this is the problem. As you know, even at any level of podcasting, whether you're doing something that's like national public radio quality or two of us talking, time and money are interchangeable concepts. So the Periodicalist, to do what I'd like to do with it, I need to find a sponsor. And I dug around a bit. And I think if I want to make that a real regular thing, I need to find someone who would underwrite not a ton of money, but just enough to handle editing, maybe a little travel, some other expense, and not even necessarily cover my time with it, but just to kind of to make sure that I'm not operating at a loss.
Right,
that's the key thing.
Well, before we get into our main topic, I just had one other thing I wanted to ask you about. That a lot of your podcasts that you're on, especially on the Incomparable stuff, is about consuming media, and lots of the panelists always talk about, well, I went and got this at the library, and I read this at the library. And one of my favorite new shows especially is Afoot, which is a mystery podcast. Are mysteries one of your sort of favorite genres or...
Yeah, and you know what's funny? I'd kind of forgotten it. Like, I got it back into science fiction and fantasy through The Incomparable, which launched, we just had our 300th episode. It's 6 years old now, mm-hmm. which seems impossible to me. And that pushed me, you know, I had kids, then that podcast launched, and it pushed me to go back and actually start reading a lot more sci-fi and fantasy than I had. And I didn't have a lot of other time. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, I'd really like to start a podcast of my own to talk about something that would be fun, that would be creative. And I'm like, you know, I've read 1,000 mysteries. Why are we not looking into that? Dug around to find other people who were like-minded. There are a million of them, and with, you know, some podcasting background. And so, yeah, it's been great. I mean, especially, again, the library thing. Like, I have a I lived in the coast of Maine for a couple of years, and there was this great tiny bookstore in Camden, Maine. The guy who ran it was called Stone Soup, but it wasn't for kids. It was just called Stone Soup. You know, we associate that
right.
as, like, a kid's thing because of the magazine. And he turned me on to Rex Stout. So I bought, you know, I think we have 80 tattered paperback versions of Nero Wolfe novels and a few other things. And I've got Simenon and these others scattered around the house. Now Marsh and so forth. And But like, again, this is where the library comes in handy, is I'm trying not to acquire as many books these days. I've hit the midpoint where I'm actually, more books will go out than come into the house. Right. And mysteries are a particularly rich way to do that because, you know, you have a genre that has, or author who's written 20 books in a series, like, am I really going to buy all 20? Like, I want to support authors, but when it's Agatha Christie, I don't feel as strongly right. about having to make sure her estate gets more money. So I'm happy to use a library for that. And the libraries, of course, are acquiring books. So I know it's not supporting authors, but so when new books come out, there's certain people I know I will make sure and buy a volume. I just read the three book series called Shadow Police by Paul Cornell, mm-hmm. who best known as a Doctor Who episode writer, but he's written a number of novels. And the third book came out, looked really fascinating. I'm like, oh, I'll buy this. I got the first two from the library, so I feel like that's the right balance. So I bought his latest work when it came out, and I was aware of it. And I've read all three, and now I'm a fan, and I'm spreading the word about Shadow Police too, because it's a great kind of not fantasy. It's like a magic London series.
Yeah, and
London is full of magic.
Yes, and a lot of those, especially older mystery series, some of them will be out of print, and so you have to go to the library kind of to get it, or just go digging through used bookstores. So, like, my wife is a big Perry Mason fan, but those books are really not in print anymore. You can't just go to a bookstore and buy them anymore. So we go to used bookstores and buy them, and then she gets them through the library, and yeah.
Again, the crying shame about, like, the public domain and orphan works and the rest. Like, there's a lot of stuff that people would be, you know, a Perry Mason book isn't going to sell 10,000 copies a year.
Right.
But the cost to turn it into a book that would sell hundreds or maybe thousands of copies a year is very low. You just have to find who owns the rights, you know, who wants to deal with this. I went to the I've told this story too many times, so I'll tell it briefly. But I went to the Library of Congress's audiovisual archives in Culpeper, Virginia. It's like 70 miles outside D.C. It's an old Federal Reserve emergency building that got converted. It's an amazing place. I went there to meet with the head of the audio section, and we're in one room, and he's showing me the NBC stuff, the shellac. NBC recorded everything in its radio studios for decades onto etching machine mm-hmm. in the studio, and they donated it to the Library of Congress. They did not donate any rights. So the material can only still be, they're digitizing all of it, can only still be listened to at a Library of Congress listening room. And this kind of thing is a crying shame because NBC cannot extract any money from that. And yet, when they signed it over, I feel, taking a copyright stance, I feel if you're donating this stuff to the Library of Congress, you have to donate something like streaming rights as well. And and so even if you can't download the stuff, you have to allow people to stream at some reasonable speed if the government is taking on the task of archiving and preserving it and digitizing it. My rant is over.
Well, and I will say in the library world, I think we're very optimistic. Hopefully by the time this airs, that we might have a new Librarian of Congress. And I think...
Oh, yeah, I'm excited about that.
And I think she would maybe push for that kind of thing a little more than our previous one did. So maybe... that kind of thing might be more common as going forward, hopefully. So
it'd be great. There just needs to be – I mean, the Library in Congress, as you know, has a lot of power. Like, yeah. I don't think – the previous one did not exercise it as much as he could have. Right. And an aggressive Library of Congress with good administrative support or presidential support or higher-level support could do a lot of interesting things under the law.
Yep. So we're – knock on wood. We're hoping for that.
Cool.
So let's go ahead and talk about the main reason you're on the show today. To talk about – you have a couple of books about Slack. Can you tell just listeners basically what Slack is if they don't know what it is?
It's a religion, Steve. It's it's the new hotness. Well, Slack is funny because I ask people around, in Seattle is a high-tech town, and I ask people, I know, I'm like, have you heard about it? Have you heard the good word? No, sorry. Have you heard about Slack? Do you use it? And there's an interesting split between like three groups of people. People who have never heard of it at all. People have heard of it and are like, oh, yeah, I kind of know what that is. We don't use it. And people who woke up one day and their company or other organization said, you're using Slack now. And they're like, oh, okay. So it's at heart, it's a group messaging system. And there's I want to start out before I get too far into it saying there's a really robust free tier. It's a freemium product. The free groups you can use where you set up a team of people, and you can have free, you can have an all free group or you can pay a monthly fee for extra features. The free flavor is really quite good. And I'm in, I think, six Slack teams and only one of them is paid, I think. And there's a bunch of limits with free, but they're not that onerous. So I'm starting out saying that. And nonprofits can, if they meet the qualifications of being, you know, 501c3 or other things, they can use Slack, the paid flavor, for free. They just have to go through a process with Slack. And there's an 85% discount for academic institutions. So I know, talking to librarians, I don't want to say, here's a new thing you can pay money for. Like, no, you don't necessarily. This could be entirely free to use, or, you know, you could have a staff of 100 and be paying a few hundred dollars a year to use a really premium product as well. So it's group communication, and it's mostly like having a group instant messaging session or a group text message. But each of those is a separate channel. So you launch the Slack client, and they have a, you know, web app that's very robust. They have native clients for iOS, Android, Mac OS X, and Windows. And they also have beta versions for a few other, you know, slightly less popular platforms at this point. And you launch the app, and you see a bunch of channels, and you're automatically joined and entered into the general channel. And then you can converse as messages with other people. And the messages can include URLs. You can upload files. There's a primitive but expanding collaborative document editing feature that's, you know, like Google Docs, not nearly as robust, but you can do it entirely inside of Slack. And the idea is that all of the communication, so it's not like a threaded messaging tool. It's not like forums. It's not a wiki. It's not a blog. It's not even text messaging at some level. But the idea is that it pulls together all of the different ways that you might communicate and exchange information. It puts it into one, instead of those being ad hoc and all over the place, and you having to find everyone's email address or use an internal directory service, you know, one of the LDAP service or something like that, to pull people up. Everyone is there. You have, you can tie it in if you have an IT system in your, you know, operation. You can tie it in with existing directory systems and use a single login, so you're not creating new accounts. But it's all in one place. So you're not like sending email to five people, waiting for a response, not sure if someone got it. Then you're texting with somebody else. Then you're using some internal system to send a query. Then you're using Dropbox to send a file. Oh, you know, that didn't work. So now I need to attach it as an email, or we're using our internal box, you know. So instead of doing all of that, it centralizes, I would say, the kind of informal communication and exchange that is a big hunk of what a lot of people wind up doing in their day in a, you know, in a commercial or nonprofit organization or academic situation.
And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here to talk about it on this particular podcast is I did ask some other librarians on Twitter, and some other libraries are already starting to use this. And I know I'm part of one Slack group, another library podcast set up. So a couple of us have had some informal kind of things. But I also like the idea that it's almost kind of like a library, and that libraries, again, like we talked about earlier, is like content creation, but it's also an institutional memory of those conversations. So it almost feels like Slack is the library almost. So.
Well, that's the thing, is when you use a group messaging, like if you're using iMessage or just text messaging or WhatsApp or whatever, how do you take the contents of those conversations, make them available to other people? If it's like something that you want, I mean, let's say there's private conversations always. But if it's something, you know, work-related or project-related, how do you get that out and stick it somewhere that other people can see when that's the intent? Everything in Slack that's on public channels, which is in most cases a lot of what's happening, anyone in the Slack group can search and get matches across every public channel. Anyone in the Slack group who is a full member, which I can explain in a moment, but that's most people are full members, they can join any public channel too, or create channels in most cases as well. So, you know, you're having a big event coming up, you create a special channel for the event, everybody involved in it joins that channel, all your discussion is there. And you may also have Trello documents or other, groupware stuff going on elsewhere. You might be using Google Docs or Google Sheets, or other tools to handle aspects of project management that are more discreet and formal and so forth. But you, instead of having 5,000 emails that you can't track in your email box and files spread all over the place, and trying to consolidate that in one place so you can figure out what happened, that's what Slack does. The other thing, the institutional memory part, the big thing that Slack pushed early on, I mean, it's only been around a couple years now, is the notion of onboarding new people. So instead of telling people like, all right, well, you know, either you have a manual for people, that's one thing, right? Or you're, again, in the middle of a project, or you're underway, and you know, just any of the common things you're working on at any time in any organization, you tell people, join this channel, scroll back like a couple weeks, and just sit down and read, like spend a few hours your first day in this read, and you can see the give and take, who's involved with what, what's been going on, and you can feel like you have a contemporary record up to the point that you start. And I've heard from a lot of people that it helps them when they join a group, it helps them feel part of that organization much more quickly because they've been able to see that kind of conversation happening as well.
Yeah, and I like that they're very open as well, because I mean they have an API that you can use, and they also, like you said, seem to integrate really well with things like Trello and Google Drive, and so it's not like you just have, you get stuck in this Slack box and then there's a different box now to be in than another one. It's nice that you can kind of mix and match.
Well, yeah, I mean it's they're making it into a platform, which is, you know, an overused term, but it really is, because they're going to be the hub for a lot of organizations. And I've seen there's a lot of tools that do this now with Slack. If you look at the app the integrations list on their apps site, they have, you know, it's like hundreds and hundreds of apps are connected, and some of those are Slack focused. Like there are concierge apps where you can say order lunch from, you know, Domino's or whatever, and it will do that. There's some nascent AI like tools that are being developed as bots that work in Slack, but a lot of the stuff is that, like, we're using Tool X, we're using Zoom for group video chat, video conversations. I was in a Slack team where we'd have the Zoom integration. So you want to start a Zoom session. Instead of going to the Zoom site and logging in and doing that, you type /Zoom and hit return, and it creates a new Zoom session, paste the URL in the field. Everyone can see it, click the URL, and you're done. Trello, you can drag a timestamp from Slack, the Slack client, into the Trello window, and any platform that lets you drag, and Trello will import the entire Slack thread and make it into like a card or deck or whatever you need to work with. I know system administrators, a fellow out in DC was telling me his setup, where instead of having all of these different things that ping him, you know, some send texts, some send email, some have their own apps and use push notifications, he's able to wire almost all of that into Slack channels that he and his partners in his consulting company, the network administration, do. So they have ways to have that all come into a single channel for them to view, instead of having all of these different things they have to monitor. And I like that. So, and I think especially knowing what I do about library IT systems, I know y'all use a lot of different stuff.
Yes.
You've got a lot of different approaches and different interfaces, and, you know, you're doing stuff that's practically terminal emulation still, or modern GUIs, you know, but it's a web front end to a back end.
Right.
Anything you're using that has an API, if you've got programming resources in-house, you know, if the integration doesn't exist, it's actually got a very lightweight way for people who are not deeply sophisticated programmers. I could do it, and I am not a sophisticated programmer. You could tie in resources you have access to into your own Slack team, but many of the tools that librarians use are used broadly enough, and because Slack is becoming a big deal, the companies that make them are going to be, have made or making integrations where you basically click, okay, add this, authenticate my login or our team's login to the system, and now you're in Slack, and you're like, okay, I need the MARC record for something. You type /MARC, you know, whatever resource number, and boom, it comes up and it gives it to you in that environment where you could copy and paste it instead of having to switch context. So
right.
I think Slack is a way to reduce context switching, is a way to keep your brain in one place too.
Yeah, no, because that's just what I was going to follow up with. Yeah, because libraries do have a lot of, we work with a lot of different vendors who don't like to work with each other a lot of times. And so, yeah, we're going from different, they don't want to integrate with each other. It's getting a little better on some fronts, but there's still a lot that don't want to integrate with each other. So,
well, this is like a neutral platform.
Yeah.
It's like the gym in West Side Story. It's like everyone can come together on Slack because you as the user are poking out to different places. So even if they don't want to talk together, you have one kind of control panel. And, you know, it's a little primitive. It's really text messaging where you can put in images. It's not like, you know, a rich multi-phasic whatever. It's in, but I think it's they're trying to, I think, put as little icing on the cake so it remains simple and efficient to use, and isn't as distracting as something that might be more, you know, might have more elements to it. But I think that integration is the key thing for any group above a certain size where you have external tools you have to use, or you've developed in-house tools that may have different interfaces. They're developed by different people at different times.
Right.
Again, I've worked in and around some libraries, but, and I know, like, you'll have a cousin who worked at, who's an executive at Pacific Bell way back in the day. And he said one of his key initiatives while he was there was reducing something like 27 screens to 8 screens because they were still using mainframe systems, right? And every screen was a different system that they were like, some people had to have 5 terminals and switch between multiple systems on each one to accomplish something. And they got it down to, you know, 8. And I'm thinking that's kind of the Slack thing is like, we're all dealing with legacy systems. Some of them now have a nice web front end to them, but they're still discrete separate systems you're sort of poking at. And a lot of the time you need a tiny bit of information or a reference or something like that. And to be able to just invoke it without having to go through the separate interface. And then you also can customize. Like when you build your own tool, I know a lot of people do this. They'll build their own web front end or something to query a more sophisticated tool. Slack is like one level even deeper than that in that it's so simple. If you just need the one thing, you don't even have to go to a website. You're just typing literally. They have these, you know, old style IRC style commands. You type slash command, like slash, you know, mark lookup or whatever. And it does the task for you and brings in graphical information if it needs to.
Yeah. And I realize that we're talking about a lot of admin stuff here. So I should say at the beginning, I didn't say the names of your books. So you have Take Control of Slack Basics, which is for everybody. And then you also have Take Control of Slack Admin for the people who would actually be administering it. And the one thing I can hear sort of it through my, through the internet, I can hear all the admins going crazy of trying to manage this, but what kind of managing, like user management, would admin people kind of have? Because I'm thinking, well, if you're using it in a professional organization, do they have the way to add people and take them out when they leave the organization, things like that, or to edit things that people put up there if that becomes an issue too?
Yeah, really, it's interesting. There's a lot of variation. It has all the tools that admins typically need, and it integrates with existing systems. So you have to be at one of the paid tiers, which, again, could be free or highly discounted if you're in a nonprofit or academic institution. Mm-hmm. But at the paid tiers, you can integrate. You can use SSO, single sign-on, with at the lowest paid tier, which is the one that nonprofits get for free, you can it'll use Google Apps or Google Logins as a way of logging in, so you don't have to create a separate account. And for the higher tier, it uses a standard thing called SAML or anything that's compliant with it, as well as a number of other systems. So if you've already got any kind of internal account system you're using for multiple logins across an intranet, you can tie that in with Slack. But it also has, you know, the Take Control of Slack Admin book is written for people who don't have an IT operation typically, because it's just, here's how you get up and running with a group communications product when you don't have a department behind you to go like, oh yeah, we've done that a million times, we'll just set it up. So Slack can work entirely in its own world, so it has its own accounts. They can be deleted, added. Administrators can let users create channels or not. If they think it's, you know, people will create too many channels, they can turn off that ability. There's a lot of ways in which administrators can dial up or dial down user level control. Mm-hmm. Editing messages is an interesting one. Administrators can delete messages in public places. I don't think they can edit them. That's a very interesting question. I don't believe in the current system an administrator can edit a message that's posted, but they can delete any message. Okay. Users can go back, unless, again, the administrators change the setting. Users, after you post a message, the message is kind of the basic unit of communication. It's like a text message or something.
Right.
And you can go back and edit the contents of it, and it'll refresh and mark that it's edited. But there's this interesting it's not a battle, but interesting thing with Slack is that even though it's a tool intended for often for companies, anything that you do privately inside Slack, so there are private channels in which multiple members can join, and the private channels aren't shown into anybody who's not a member. So someone creates a private channel, invites other people, no one else in the Slack group, including the administrator or the person who set up the team, knows they even exist. And there's also direct messaging that's much more like kind of an exact duplicate of group text messaging. All those private messages, the administrators and team owners cannot see them. You have to pay at the highest level of Slack team and apply to Slack for something called compliance exports, where you have to prove you're in an industry where this is required. And only then will they let team owners export the entire contents of a team, including private messages. And even then, all users in the team are informed that all their messages are subject to being exported for compliance reasons. So for most teams, all the free teams and most other teams, anything you do privately in Slack, even if you're working at a company, the company owners cannot see it, which is a a remarkable degree of privacy baked into a system that's designed, like I say, largely for companies and other organizations.
Yeah, no, I was surprised when you just said that. I didn't realize that it was that private.
I had to confirm it with them because I thought, I'm reading this wrong. There must be a way that admins can go and see private channels and private messages. They're like, nope, you can't. I'm like, okay, it's just a system design. So that may not appeal. Some companies will not want that, or some organizations, they might have policies, it might even be, this is an issue I know with libraries that are attached to public institutions. Like, what is the message retention policy? You know, if you're right. using private messaging in Slack, does that actually violate open records laws and so forth? So that's going to be an issue, I know, in some cases as well.
And what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So there's the web interface and then there is the apps. Is there an advantage to using one or the other? I mean, I know the web would be more ubiquitous that everybody could have access to it, but does one like offer more features than the other?
Well, the big difference, I think, is background stuff on mobile. Like on the, if you switch between the web interface and the desktop apps on Windows or OS X, which I was doing while writing the books, the differences are pretty slight. And a lot of browsers let you do desktop notifications. So an app could do a notification or a browser could do a notification as long as you've enabled it. Okay. Because one of the things Slack does is it like messaging tools, it tells you when something happened, right? But you can adjust what that is. And in fact, I have a whole chapter in the basics book on tweaking notifications so you're not being totally over-notified all the time, but you're also not missing important things. So somebody mentions you, like Twitter, you use an at handle to mention somebody. Mm-hmm. And so I say, you know, at Steve Thomas, oh, yeah, here's that information you wanted. If you're not notified of that, then you might – Slack will also give you visual indications in the client. Like it'll put a one in a circle okay. on the channel. There's other things. But you may want to always know when someone mentions you. Well, you can get mobile push notifications in Android and iOS and desktop notifications. On the mobile side, as you know, there's that limitation that if you want to do push notifications, it has to be a native app. And that's true. I don't think Android has a workaround either. They may have a little more flexibility. So if you want that kind of mobile functionality, you have to use the native app. And then the other thing is some stuff can happen in the background. It can track certain things and alert you. And that staying logged in, like being shown as active in Slack, if you're using the web app, I think it times out faster than if you're using the mobile apps. The apps are only thin frameworks around a web app, basically, but so they've kind of only pick up the ecosystem stuff that a web app can't do. And like, and notifications is the big one, but right. There's some security issues too. Some people don't want to use a browser for any kind of communication like that because browsers are too easily hacked. You know, you get some malware, someone installs a plugin, you go to the wrong site. When you're using a native app, ostensibly because it's been signed by, cryptographically signed by the developer mm-hmm. through the distribution party, you can be much more sure that it hasn't been modified. And then you're relying on the cryptographic acumen of the company instead of relying on Safari or Internet Explorer or Chrome or something that could be problematic. So for security reasons, I expect a lot of IT departments would say, use the native apps, don't use the web apps.
Okay. And so we've talked a lot about why you would use this in your institution, but what, and I think you said you're in a bunch of groups, but they're not all work related. So why would you want to have a Slack just like with your friends and things like that, or more informal groups? One thing I can think of is social media is starting to get a little more, I guess, toxic is a good word for it sometimes.
It's a great word for it, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's one thing is that you can all kind of escape to your own little world kind of and have the same sort of interactions. But, I mean, are there other reasons you can think of to want to set up a personal kind of Slack?
Yeah, this is like the Shakers. You know, people wanted to set up an intentional community.
Yes.
I mean, Slack is intentional. So, I mean, right. So the work case is easy because you need to communicate in a work environment. And this is a great tool for that can replace or collect a bunch of other tools. Socially, or, you know, I think it's great for, it was interesting after writing the books, heard a lot of interesting uses for families even. The deal is because Slack works in every platform, there aren't that many things that you can communicate with that work in every platform that everyone will use that doesn't require installing an app. So Facebook is one of those, and a lot of people don't want to join Facebook. So at some level, if you have a group of people you want to communicate with and you can get them to all agree to create a Slack account on a team you set up, this is an alternative to Facebook, basically. I mean, that's sort of weird, but it's true.
Yeah.
So it's your own, you know, and I have a group. There's a bunch of freelance writers. We have a group. There's only, I don't know, like 12 of us in it. We don't talk all the time in it. It's not something, sometimes there are no posts for days, but that group of people is across several time zones. Like we spread across 8 hours of time zones. We have different lives, different working habits. If I was using text messaging, like, or if I was using WhatsApp or iMessage, I couldn't use because some of them don't have iPhones or Macs.
Right.
And text messaging is sort of more intrusive. So Slack, you can control the notification level and you can mute it and turn it off really easily. So it lets people get in and out of the group without feeling compelled to see and read and hear everything. And so if as long as you have people in your, like, I mean, this is a family thing, but also works in the social setting too, is it's often hard to get someone to install an app, even if they have a smartphone. Some people on possibly on the older side, possibly on the younger side, don't have a smartphone at all, right? They only have a desktop machine or a laptop or a Chromebook or something. And they can use Slack just as well as someone with a mobile phone. And this focus has been so much on mobile over the last several years that everyone forgets that, you know, there is this world of that's more inclusive. So if you're, say, helping to manage a kid's soccer team, if you could get every parent on one Slack group, you know, and you can integrate, there's you can be a free group, so you're not paying anything. You can integrate very easily, like a calendaring software like Google or something else without paying for it. Again, it's just you're connecting one service to another. Slack supports IFTTT as well. So if you know that recipe service, you can use that. And IFTTT will provide the glue to a bunch of other things, so you don't have to plug those all into Slack directly. But I was just thinking about the times I've tried to organize anything with a community group a few years ago. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can get everyone to use Slack. You know, everyone's already going to use email. That's like a given now. Like that, we've gotten over that hurdle. Like my community has aged enough that, so we're all going to use email. I'm like, well, if you can use email, Slack is one step better for a lot of groups, because then again, that institutional memory you talk about, it works for informal groups too. I mean, a book club could have a Slack and use it to talk about books on the off weeks, or just everyone get together in the Slack group. You don't have to all be at the same time to decide on a common time to do something. I'm the Incomparable Network. We have a Slack and there's like 50 of us in there now, I think, so many programs. And we, you know, shoot the breeze about a lot of stuff, but we also, you know, brainstorm for topics for a show, or we'll talk through something. If we all, like, someone saw a new episode of something, and they say, should we do a TV podcast episode about this? See if there's enough people that have interest. So it's like both, it's informal and casual, but also collective. And because, again, if you're especially across time zones, you can catch everybody in the Slack. They can get caught up when they wake up, right? You go to sleep, they wake up, they see all the discussion, and they don't wake up and have 40,000 messages on their phone, right? They're not looking at their screen going, oh, now I have to read, you know, 50 text messages. It's just a much better environment to scroll back. Think about search within text messages. Are you an Apple ecosystem person?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so how do you search iMessage across platforms? It's terrible. The interfaces are all awful. Slack, at some level, is, you could conceive of it entirely as iMessage, but better. You could literally use it just in that way and get everybody who you currently iMessage with and who all know each other into Slack, into one team. And you could create, you know, some people create a lot of teams, which becomes a management problem. You can switch between them and the Slack clients, but then, you know, you don't want to have 50 teams. I think I'm hitting the limit. Like, six is probably enough, even with some low traffic ones. I read, there's a lot of these, like, Slack is dead articles already. And one person wrote it was in 15 groups. I'm like, oh, well, for you, that's too many. Like, right, that is a problem. If any of them get more than, like, one post a day, you're switching constantly, and it doesn't make – it's not better than email suddenly, right, because you're switching context so much.
Right. Well, we have one last story we want to get to about libraries.
Oh. Let me tell you the URL, though. If you want more information, I got this awesome URL,
yes.
slackhelp.me. If you go there, there's an explanation of the books. There's excerpts you can download, chapters from the book, and details on how to purchase. And we also, librarians always interested in this, we have bulk purchase discounts and nonprofit bulk purchase discounts. So
excellent. So go to, what was it, slackhelp.me?
Slackhelp.me. I know. I was trying to find something I could say on a podcast. You can type anything. Slackhelp.me.
Slack, help me. You're my only hope.
You're my only hope, exactly.
So you are researching an article currently, I think, or a story. I'm not sure what your eventual format's going to be on that, that you're going to be visiting locally for me, virtually visiting Oglethorpe University. Can you talk about that story of what you're looking into and how librarians have been helpful for you?
Oh, yeah. I thought you would love this because – and your listeners too. Hello. Because it's it's like – it's the value of libraries and the persistence and absence of memory that libraries are key and archivists are key involved in. So the short story is in 1940, a 2,000-square-foot vault called the Crypt of Civilization was sealed at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta, Georgia. It's a small private liberal arts college. I hope it's well endowed. I was looking it up because we want it to last for 6,000 years until the vault gets opened. It's got like what was, I think, at the time one of the most sophisticated stainless steel doors in the world ever built was sealed. It's got ceramic tile inside and multiple foot, I think, limestone walls. The bedrock is granite there. And everything's been sealed with air evacuated from items in glass tubes. 640,000 pages of microfilmed, or 630,000 pages were micro-photographed onto microfilm that's sealed there. There's a wind-powered phonograph so that it can play back sounds, assuming there's no source of electricity when it's opened. Fascinating thing, and the guy who developed this idea, Thornwell Jacobs, was the president of Oglethorpe. Fascinating guy. So that's – I was writing about this in brief for a story about – for The Atlantic, in which a website is shutting down, and it's a site that lets people share photographs and thoughts about these photographs, typically while they're traveling. And they are going to keep the archives up on the web forever by their definition, but they wanted to provide a permanent archive. So they're printing the entire site onto metal plates, onto nickel plates that have an estimated 10,000-year lifespan. And I'm writing this, and that's a fascinating story in itself. So I'm writing this story about that, and I'm like, well, I should look about, you know, previous time capsule efforts. And in Oglethorpe, the Crypt of Civilization leaps to the top right away. And I find this article, the Times, New York Times, created a time capsule project for the millennium, and they wrote about it in 1999. I remember this. I go and look it up. It mentions the Oglethorpe vault. And it has this quote that's wonderful that ostensibly is it's said that Robert Sarnoff, who is – I'm sorry, David Sarnoff, who is the head of RCA at the time, he delivered these words at the closing of the vault. I'm like, oh, this is perfect, but I need to find a primary source. The New York Times is obviously not a primary source, right? It's a secondary source. So I started to dig this up, and this is an incidental thing. David Sarnoff is actually a distant relative of mine on my mother's side, and we haven't had any really contact with the family for decades, but it's sort of funny. So he is alleged to have said in this New York Times article, you know, quoting him in 1940, "The world is now engaged in burying our civilization forever, and here in this crypt we leave it to you." Great words. Mm-hmm. So I start digging. Turns out, and so I'm like, all right, well, newspaper archives the way to go. I use, I wound up signing up for newspapers.com for a previous project I was working on because a lot of the material that I need is past the 1922 cutoff. Because I can use the Library of Congress archives, of course, for 1922 and before. They have an amazing scanned archive. So I'm looking at newspapers.com, and I'm like, well, I should find these articles in Atlanta. And at the time, there was the Atlanta Journal and the Atlanta Constitution, you know, competing newspapers that eventually merged to become, as you know, the AJC.
Yes.
And so one of the things I first find while I'm searching Google Books and newspapers.com is a book about time capsules by William Jarvis, and came out in 2003, and it quotes this. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe this is where the New York Times got the quote. And he has a reference. He has a primary citation, the Atlanta Journal, May 26, 1940, page one, this guy named Dudley Byline, and it references it, right? I'm like, all right, well, I'll just find that online. Atlanta Journal has not been digitized. The AJC and the Atlanta Constitution have, and everywhere you look for Atlanta Journal, it says it has, but it hasn't. Only – right. So I'm thinking, all right, well, I don't know how far down this hole I want to go. And, you know, I dig up, I discover I have a mutual friend with the author of this time capsules book. So I'm trying to get in touch with him. And meanwhile, I'm looking at newspapers and I cannot find anybody who was on the site, who did a first-person account of the closing of the vault. But I discover David Sarnoff wasn't there in 1940. He was there in 1938. He was given an honorary degree. He went down. He gave some talk, of which there is no record in anything I could find. And so this quote is misattributed. He was not there in 1940. In 1938, they were dedicating this stainless steel door. So anyway, this is it's maddening for me as a reporter. I'm like, I want primary sources. I'm not going to repeat the New York Times error.
Right.
And I'm not going to attribute this incorrectly. And I want to know whether they got the words right. So in the end, I go to the University of Georgia, Atlanta. A librarian there kindly goes into the microfilm. I believe they have the only holding of the Atlanta Journal on microfilm in the world.
Yep.
There may be one somewhere else in archives someplace. Maybe right. Library of Congress has it. He goes and digs it up. He says, there is no such story. And I'm like, are you sure? And he's like, there's some cover. You know, he looks through. He sends me some scans of a few things. He's like, there's nothing in the first, in the cover of A or B. There's nothing in the first thing. And so I'm back in touch with him. Hmm. I go to Oglethorpe University, which promotes – they lost track of this vault actually for a number of years. Hmm. It was almost rediscovered in 1990, which is a whole other story. And they're a very helpful person there, talks to their internal archivist. He sends me some pages from the Atlanta Journal, but there was a special section that I don't know is on microfilm, and he didn't have page one of it. So I still don't have a record of this. I'm going crazy at this point because I'm like, I want to know, and I'm past the Atlanta story, the Atlantic story is filed, but I'm thinking this is a good source citation story. I look to see, I know that Thornwell Jacobs, president of Oglethorpe University, wrote a memoir. I know this because it's cited. I look in OCLC, in WorldCat. There are like 16 copies in the world. Mm-hmm. I cannot find a copy to purchase anywhere. I've put out used book searches. This book has vanished into the mists of time, except in some library holdings. There is one at the Seattle Central Library. It is non-circulating, Steve. It is non-circulating.
Of course.
Unlike your podcast, it's not circulating. So I go to the library, and it's sitting on the shelf. The book is as pristine as if it has not been touched since it was published in about 1955. And I think it has not been touched in that time.
Never circulated.
It's never circulated. So 1,000 pages long, and I'm taking pictures madly with one of those apps that does the keystoning. So mm-hmm. you take a picture and it fixes it, right? And so I'm just taking pictures of everything about the vault in it, and it's 1,000 pages long because the guy had a big ego. And like a third is a memoir, a third is his journal entries for every day of his adult life, and a third is every speech and thought he ever had. And I finally, so I photograph all this stuff. I get home and I finally find the quote. It is not the quote this New York Times. He had this statement that he read, unless he read it wrong and was transcribed by a reporter in an account I can't find, it is not the words that are in the New York Times. Somewhat different, slightly different intent. I contact the Sarnoff archives. And they very kindly, they find the speech David Sarnoff gave in 1938. They scan it and send it to me. That is the only copy of that speech in the world I would warrant at this point. And it's this beautifully printed speech because everything, I'm sure at that in those days, anything anyone ever said was beautifully printed.
Yeah.
So I'm still at this point now. It's that, but I'm like, this vault was designed to last 6,100 something years. The story, it was almost forgotten and lost. Within 40 years, right. 1990, some people rediscovered it who were at the university, including William Jarvis. I don't think William Jarvis was part of that. Newt Berger, who helped form the International Time Capsule Organization, which helps maintain records of this kind of thing now. But I mean, come on. Isn't this – I mean, this must be maddening to you to hear too. It's like, so we're yes. only – this happened in 1940, and I cannot determine the historicity, and digital archives are incomplete, and this is a topper. I got in touch with the New York Times and said, you've got an error. Here's my citations, and I could send you scans of things. And the Times is like, well – we don't usually fix stories that are that old unless it's something really significant. I'm like, you are the authoritative right. version online. And I wrote them back and said, you are the one source for this online and you're wrong. But we'll see. That's my story. Well, thank you to all the librarians who helped me. I've had help from, I think, 5 different archivists and librarians, and I still don't have the primary documents I need, but I'm getting closer.
Well, if we have some follow-up to this, I'll post it on the site.
Oh my God! So I'm writing an article that's sort of about the Oglethorpe's crypt, and the persistence of memory, but also a little bit about this source traveling. But thank you. And I figure your audience is an audience that will appreciate that story.
Yes.
Possibly more than any other audience.
Yes. And that'll be in the Atlantic. Is that right? Or this is for somewhere else?
This will be at meh.com. M-E-H.
Oh, yeah.
I've been writing some interesting stories for them. They're mostly like a site that has a bargain of the day, but they're trying to beef up the content in their forums. And they're like, write interesting things. I'm like, I think I can do that. So this will be partly about time capsules and the vault, and partly about the fact that we can't even remember something for 76 years accurately.
Yeah, and we're and we're low on time, so I won't go into it too much, but I will provide a link in the show notes to your story about the all caps meaning shouting going back 150 years too. So that's
another shout out. Thank you to archivists and librarians for that.
All right, well, Glenn, thank you so much for talking to me today. And where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have a blog at glog, G-L-O-G, dot glennf, G-L-E-N-N-F, dot com. Or you can find me on Twitter, where I tweet way too much, at glennf, G-L-E-N-N-F. But I warn you, I do tweet way too much.
And it was, I'm going to try to remember, slackhelp.me?
Slackhelp.me. Yeah, it worked. Slackhelp.me for information about the books.
All right. Well, thanks, Glenn.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Find out more about the show at circulatingideas.com, including links to old episodes, transcripts, and how you can help support the show. You can find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or follow it on Twitter at @circideas. To help others find the show, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice, and keep circulating your ideas.
I don't know if we'll be able to afford the one that comes through Seattle in like 2 years or something.
They announced it's going to come to Atlanta, but yeah, we're already saving up our money now.
Yeah, that's – well, did they do the thing? The local theater group here is like, you probably want to get 2016, 2017 tickets, season tickets, if you want to be in the running to get 2017, 2018 season tickets and get to see Hamilton. It's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, we thought about the same thing. I was like, well, maybe we should go ahead. Because we did that a few years ago before we had the kids, because we had more time to go do that kind of stuff. And now it's like, well, we don't always have time to drive down into the city and do this stuff.
Well, if they let you sell season tickets.
It might be worth it for Hamilton.
Yeah, if they let you sell season tickets, then you could see a couple shows and, you know, sell the rest for the current season or something, too.
Yeah.
Some of them do the ticket exchange as well. I don't know. It's a lot of money. A lot of money. Theater's expensive and nobody makes any money. So how does that work? Except Hamilton.